Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is March the 6th, and we are in Shmos in our redemption class, page 298. And last time we went through this, we talked about how Moshe came to Midian, and he came to the well, and there he encountered Yisro's daughters who were being chased away by the shepherds, and he saved them. And they told their father that an Egyptian man saved us, and he said, "Where is he? Go back." Or they said, "Why'd you leave him there? Call him and he'll eat bread," which means maybe he'll marry one of you. And that is what happened. He married Tzipora. And we said that it says also that Moshe agreed to stay with the man, with Yisro. He gave him Tzipora to marry. And he had a son, Gershom. We mentioned last time also that the word Vayoel, the first word in Pasuk Chaf Aleph in verse 21, can also mean "and he swore, he took an oath," which we said that Moshe swore to Yisro, first of all, that he would not leave without Yisro's permission, and second of all, he also swore a very interesting thing or surprising type of oath, which is that the first son that he would have, he would not raise him specifically to be a Jew, but the first son would follow the route of Yisro and would experiment with other religions. We're going to get to that this evening. Now, first of all, let's go back to Tes Zion to 16. It says, "Ulechohen Midyan Sheva Banos," to the Kohen of Midyan, he had seven daughters. "Vatavona Vatidlena," they came and they drew water. "Vatimalena is Hara Hatim," and they filled the troughs. "Lahashkos tzon avihen," to water the flock of their father. "Vayavohu horoim vayugarishum," and the shepherds came and chased them away. "Vayakama Moshe vayoshiyan," Moshe got up and he saved them. "Vayashk es tzonam," and he watered their flock. "Vatovono el Ruel avihen," they came to Ruel their father. "Vayomer," and he said, "Madua miharten bo hayom," why were you quick to come home today? "Vatomana," and they said, "Ish mitzri hitzilonu miyad haro'im," an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. "Vegam dolo dololanu," and he also drew water for us. "Vayashk es hatzon," and he watered the sheep. So we pointed many of these questions out last time. I'm going to repeat some of them tonight so we can talk about them a little bit more in depth. One is that perhaps the most difficult way of reading, the most difficult point here is that if Yisro said to his daughters, "Why did you come home quickly today?" And the answer is, "Because Moshe saved us," then that means this was a daily occurrence. It happened daily that they were delayed in coming home, because normally Moshe wasn't there to help them. So normally they would be chased away by the shepherds and then get home late. Now that's a strange thing, that it should be a daily ritual, and so then don't go if they're going to constantly chase you away.
Why didn't he go to do something?
Could be he wasn't able to. Now, so it would seem to imply that he was also unable to help them.
Isn't it also unbecoming, knowing his position, that he was Yisrael? He must have had a high position among the people there.
Well, what we learned last time is that Yisrael had been in a very high position, but he was excommunicated because he repudiated idolatry.
Okay.
And he believed in one God. So he's called Kohen Midyan. Kohen can either mean a priest, meaning not necessarily a pagan priest, but it means a someone who is involved in the religion, in the religious service. That's a Kohen. A Kohen can also mean a leader. Yisro was both. He was someone involved in the religious service. He was also a leader. But he had been recently excommunicated because he had given up paganism and had decided to follow the one God. So when that happened, he was unable to be seen in public, and his daughters had to go to water the sheep, to water the flock, and they were constantly harassed. So the Medrash tells us that normally the reason why they were always late coming home is because the shepherds would not allow Yisro's daughters to draw water until they had drawn water. So they would draw water and they would put it in the troughs and water their own flocks, and only after they were completely finished, then the daughters of Yisro were given the were allowed to then come and water their flocks. Because since Yisro and his family were excommunicated, so then they had no choice but to go last. So that was the normal chain of events. Now here, Moshe comes to the well, and while he's at the well, the daughters of Yisro come and they draw water and they fill the troughs. So a departure happens from what has happened in the past. Normally, the daughters of Yisro would have to wait until all the shepherds were finished before they got to use the well and the troughs. But this time, they were able to go first.
And only explain, Rabbi, why the shepherds didn't go first.
Okay, so then why over here did they not go first? So it doesn't tell us why. The Medrash just says it happened to be that day the daughters got there first. Now there could be two possible reasons for this. One, well, I shouldn't say two possible reasons, I should say two that are evident to us. One is that Hashem arranged it that way, and as Hashem wanted Moshe to see the shepherds chasing away the daughters of Yisro. So Hashem arranged it that day, the daughters of Yisro happened to get there first, no one else was there, and they tried to sneak in and get it before everybody else did. But while they were in the process, they had filled up the troughs, the shepherds came and they said, "What are you doing here?" And they chased away the daughters of Yisro. So Moshe witnesses this. Had it been the other way around, had it been the daily occurrence that the daughters of Yisro would have had to wait on the sidelines until the shepherds were finished watering their own flock, then Moshe, there wouldn't have been no injustice that Moshe would have had to stand up for, because there would have been no chasing away and nobody harassing anybody. They just had to wait because whatever reason, they had to wait. So it could be that, for, you know, and of course Hashem has millions of ways of delaying people and making one person come before another person. And we, you know, there was a, you know, there was traffic on the highway, whatever it was, the shepherds came late. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that Moshe being there intimidated the shepherds, because it says that Moshe was there at the well. Moshe was dwelling at the well. Then the daughters of Yisro came and they filled the troughs, and then the shepherds came and chased away the daughters. So it is possible that Moshe being there intimidated the shepherds so they weren't willing to stop the daughters of Yisro until they actually filled up the troughs, and that already was too much, and then they came and they chased away the daughters. But it could be that they hesitated because Moshe was there, which means Moshe would have been an imposing figure. Moshe dressed in his Egyptian garb. Moshe also was dressed, was from Paro's house. He may have been wearing some sort of princely garment. Whatever the possibilities are, they may have been intimidated because of him.
My thought when I'd read it the first, last week or whatever, was, last time, was when it says that they drew the water, that they did that every time, mm-hmm. every day. They made the girls work, chase them away, and they got their, you know, got the water without having to work for it.
Right, so that is possible. The Medrash doesn't say it that way, but that is a possibility. But then the daughters, you would think, would have learned that lesson, just don't show up right away.
Right.
You know. Now, this is the third episode with Moshe that we have since Moshe grew up. Remember, the first episode was he came outside and he saw an Egyptian viciously beating his a fellow Jew, killed the Egyptian. Comes out the next day, sees two Jews fighting, and he intervenes. They inform Paro that he murdered the Egyptian. Paro tries to execute him. Moshe runs away. Now he's at the well, and he sees seven young women come and fill up a trough with the troughs for their sheep, and then he sees the shepherds chase away the young women, and he steps forward and saves them from the shepherds. So we see three episodes with Moshe, the first three that we see since Moshe has matured, and all three involve Moshe intervening. Moshe is not willing to sit on the sidelines. Moshe is not willing to stand by and watch injustice or inappropriate behavior. He sees an Egyptian beating a Jew, he intervenes, he kills the Egyptian. He sees two Jews fighting, he intervenes, he says, "Why are you hitting him?" Moshe is not willing to stand aside and watch either injustice or inappropriate behavior. He sees the daughters of Yisro fill the troughs and then be chased away, he intervenes. It's not a question of whether he considered it to be an injustice or not. Many people consider things to be wrong, but don't step forward and do anything about it. Moshe was not willing to sit back and watch injustice or inappropriate behavior. Moshe feels the need to intervene. And this is, of course, a hallmark of a leader. A leader does not stand by as things happen and just let them happen. Sometimes a leader deliberately lets something happen, but that's only because they've thought about it and decided it's better for whatever is happening to go on. But a leader takes action and never just lets it go. There has to be some thought process over what's going to happen. Many people will not get involved because it's not my place to get involved. Who am I to get involved? Why should I step in? Yes, there's injustice. Yes, there's something, but it's not for me to get involved. We've all been in positions like that where it's inappropriate for us to get involved. These people, they're involved, whatever. But Moshe does not do that. And this our introduction to Moshe is one of a person who gets involved. Yes.
No, he even when he saw the burning bush, he went.
Yeah. Let's get to the burning bush.
Oh, okay.
Now,
is this to show us his need of compassion, kindness? Because if this episode deals with human beings and later with the sheep. So
yeah, we haven't gotten to later yet. And here there was an episode where he sees two people fighting. That's not compassion. That's inappropriate behavior. Yeah. And he steps in and he says, "Why are you hitting each other?"
Mm.
Right. So it's not strictly compassion. We don't want to. We could talk about compassion, but that's limiting it. It's okay. Not strictly that. It is a willingness to get involved. That's what Moshe. That's what Moshe demonstrates. You know, organizations constantly are looking for volunteers, constantly looking for people to get involved, get involved, get involved, and nobody wants to get involved. So Moshe is a person who gets involved. The commentaries pick out the word in Pasuk Yud Ches, verse 18, Vayoshion, and he saved them. What did he save them from? They were chased away. The word "he saved them" is a little bit too strong of a word. If people are being chased away, you're not saving them when you step forward and help them out. Saving them from what? Saving them means from a danger. You may be righting the wrong, you may be helping them, but saving implies that there was something more serious going on. And therefore, The Gemara tells us that the Medrash, actually the sages say that one of the sages says that the shepherds were attempting to molest the daughters of Yisro. They weren't simply chasing them away, but they were actually attacking them, and therefore Moshe saved them from the shepherds. And another one of the sages says that they actually tried to kill the daughters of Yisro by throwing them into the water, by actually trying to drown them, and Moshe saves them from attempted murder. In fact, that second opinion uses the words later on in Pasuk Yud Tes verse 19, that when they answer their father, he says, "Why'd you come home so quickly today?" And they say, "An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. V'gam dolo dala lanu, and he also drew." Now, the way we read this is he drew water for us. He drew for us. But another way to read it is he drew us from the water. Mm-hmm. He pulled us out. They had thrown us in, and he pulled us out. That would be the other way to read that verse. It doesn't mean to say that he didn't draw water, but there's a double meaning to imply that their lives were in danger and he saved them.
That couldn't have been a daily occurrence.
No.
Why today? Why this?
Because
they were trying to show off in front of Moshe?
No, not to show off. This would be because since the daughters had the chutzpah to draw water first, now the shepherds weren't content to simply chase them off. They actually took action against them. That would be that since normally the daughters waited on the side, this time they went first. The shepherds now were incensed, and they either tried to molest them or to kill them. We pointed out last time that the daughters tell their father that an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. An Egyptian man. When the fact is that they mistook Moshe for an Egyptian. Now, why would they mistake him for an Egyptian?
Because he's wearing an Egyptian outfit.
He must be wearing an Egyptian outfit. Otherwise, if he wasn't wearing Egyptian outfit, why would they think he's Egyptian? Or he spoke Egyptian. So they mistook him for an Egyptian. We know that two of the things that our ancestors always maintained when they were in Egypt to avoid becoming assimilated with the Egyptian culture is
our language and our dress.
They did not change their language and they did not change their mode of dress. They kept their clothing. They wore distinctly Jewish clothing. And they also spoke distinctively Jewish language. Those were two of the reasons why we merited to go out of Egypt. We'll expand upon that in a minute. But the fact is that Moshe did not do that. Now, it's understandable why not, because Moshe was in the palace. But here, when he's at the well, he does not demonstrate himself to be a Jew, but rather an Egyptian. The Medrash says that this is one of the reasons why Moshe did not enter the land of Israel. We know that later on in the Chumash, Moshe will lose the right to enter the land of Israel because he strikes the rock instead of speaking to the rock. Now that doesn't happen till the end of the 40 years in the wilderness. However, between now and then, we will find several other things that Moshe does, all of which the Medrash will say resulted in his not being allowed to enter the land of Israel. Now, how do we understand that? I mean, if it was because he hit the rock and didn't speak to the rock, that's the reason, not these other reasons. The way that's to be understood is as follows. A person can do something, and because they do that, the decree from heaven is that a bad thing is going to happen. But the decree can be changed. A person can daven, and it can change. A person can do teshuva, can repent, and it can change. A person can do a mitzvah, which might change the decree. The decrees are always changing in heaven. Things are, you know, there are moving parts because we're constantly changing. We're constantly doing good things and unfortunately bad things. So the decrees are constantly shifting in heaven. This is the first, I believe, the first reference to Moshe not being allowed to enter the land of Israel. But at this point, it was still fluid. It could have changed. Had Moshe corrected the wrong, had Moshe done teshuva, repented, had Moshe prayed, things could have changed. The thing that he did that sealed the deal, and no matter what he did, he couldn't change the decree, was when he hit the rock and didn't speak to the rock. At that point, Hashem said, that's it, nothing will change my mind, you can't go into the land of Israel. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. It couldn't be any more changing of the decree. At this point, the decree was not set in stone, but here we find the first of several, and hopefully I'll remember as we move along to point out to you the other ones that we'll find. There are at least two, perhaps three more that I can think of now that will come up before hitting the rock. So this is one of them, because he shows himself as an Egyptian and not as a Jew. Now, just to digress for a moment about this not changing one's dress or one's language. So, one can argue today we are in a foreign culture. It is not our culture. And yet, we speak the language of the culture that we're in. And we dress like the culture that we're in. Perhaps we dress a little more modestly, but the types of clothing that we wear are the same clothing as the culture around us. We can shop at the same stores and find clothing. We may have a little bit more of a discerning eye towards modesty, and it may be a little more difficult to find the clothing that is more modest, especially for women, but that it still is the same, it's essentially the same clothing. So, in what way do we fulfill this concept of not changing our language or our dress, or maybe we don't need to fulfill that concept? And just to contrast what we do, just take a look at the Hasidish community. Hasidim tend to dress like our ancestors did in Europe. They do look very different from the culture around them, from the American culture. And Hasidim also tend to be insular in how they speak, preferring Yiddish over English. In those two ways, in their dressing in a more European way, old world European way, and in their adherence to Yiddish, they seem to be more like our ancestors in Egypt that maintained the distinctly Jewish mode of dress and the distinctly Jewish mode of speech. So there seems to be two different approaches in American Jewry, whether we do stand out in the way we dress and speak or not. And I'd like to address that for a moment. Yes,
Rabbi, it says he was in royalty type clothing, and Egypt being a superior nation would give him more strength in a smaller foreign country.
So it gave him more credibility.
Yeah.
So when we say that Moshe was criticized for appearing Egyptian, we have to remember, and thank you for pointing this out, we have to remember that any criticism of Moshe is going to be a very subtle thing. We're not talking about terrible sins. Right. Even when he strikes the rock, it doesn't speak to the rock. When we get to that episode, which will take us a long time, but when we get to that episode, please God, we will show that even there was a very subtle mistake. And we're not talking about some sort of evil intention or something like that. You know, we're still talking about Moshe after all. So we'll explain it when we get there. But you're right. We're talking about a subtlety. There was good reason to dress Egyptian-like because it gave him more strength, more power, more standing. That's correct. Yeah.
When you refer to the Hasidim and dressing in the old way, I've always been puzzled, though, because at some point in time, the way they dress must have been the way
normal.
Everybody
right. Right. When in Europe, when they dressed that way, that was the way Europeans dressed. It was a cold climate, and that was the typical mode of dress. Now Yiddish as a Jewish language, that most of our ancestors, unless anybody in the room is Sephardi, most of our ancestors did that as well. Even in Europe, Yiddish was a distinctly Jewish way of speaking. It wasn't that much different than, for example, German, but it was a distinctly Jewish dialect. Everybody knew you were speaking Jewish. And even in the Sephardi countries, they often spoke Hebrew or Ladino or one of the other dialects that was distinctly Jewish. So really, historically speaking, America is unusual in that here we speak English, we speak a fluent English, and in our way of speech, we are not so distinct from the culture around us.
Yeah. I've been learning about Samson Raphael Hirsch, who, when in Europe the Jews were so threatened with assimilation, he said, we can wear jackets, we can speak German. I mean, he accepted this pressure and thought it was a means to, he thought, to rescue the Jews from their isolation.
Yeah, there were some who did that. There were some who did that. It's hard to know, it's hard to gauge what the results of that were, since European Jewry was wiped out. So it's very difficult to gauge you know, what would have happened or how would things have turned out. But addressing it as an issue of how distinct do we need to be, so this is a very big issue and a very large question, something which is clearly not something we can spend a huge amount of time on this evening. But it is a struggle that Jews have throughout the diaspora, throughout these 2,000 years of exile, of how distinct do we need to be? We know on the one hand that we have to maintain ourselves as Jews, and we cannot become subsumed by the culture in which we live, otherwise we're not Jews anymore. And we need to avoid that type of assimilation. At the same time, we also need to survive in the culture in which we live, and the more that we are able to converse and deal with the people around us, the more we're able to survive. It's very difficult to earn a living if we are unable to have some sort of interface with the country around us. That has become more so in America. In Europe, a lot of the time, it wasn't necessarily by choice that the Jews were segregated. The whole idea of the ghetto, etc., often it was imposed upon us by the culture around us. In America, for the first time, we really have sweeping freedoms, and as a result, there is more of a breakdown in the barriers that existed historically between us and the host culture in which we lived. But dealing with it strictly as a question of, didn't our ancestors in Egypt maintain their own language and their own mode of dress? What about us? Just answering that question without getting into the specifics of how distinct should we be and how assimilated should we be. The one approach or one answer to that question is that in Egypt, they didn't have anything else. What else would have shown them to be Jews? What else would have made them a separate and distinct culture? Now, they were slaves, but there were other slaves in Egypt. What made them separate and distinct? What made them separate and distinct was the way they spoke, the way they dressed. There was no Torah. There was no Torah with all of its commandments, with all of its statutes, etc., to maintain the Jews as a separate people. However, today, once the Torah has been given to us, the Torah itself makes us a distinct nation. When we adhere to the Torah, we are already separate and distinct. We already act differently. The whole concept of kosher food creates a clear distinction between us and the culture around us. Shabbos creates a clear distinction between us and the culture around us. And not just those two, but even the different holidays that we keep, that we're keeping Pesach, and we keep Rosh Hashanah, we keep Yom Kippur. These are things that the people around us, Purim, which is coming up, Mirz Hashem, very soon, in 2 weeks. So they're also, the culture around us doesn't have any connection to those things. So that also creates a distinction. And therefore, one could argue that the need for distinct dress and distinct language is not as acute once we have the Torah, which itself segregates us.
Yeah. But Rabbi, when did the oral Torah originate? Was it in Egypt at the time?
The oral Torah was given to Moshe at Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
So it didn't originate till then. Now, you're correct that we know that our ancestors, even before the Torah was given, already knew through prophecy much of the Torah, going all the way back to Noach. We know he knew the difference between kosher animals and non-kosher animals. He took only 2 non-kosher animals of each species, but he took 14 of the kosher animals. So, because he wanted to bring sacrifices after the flood. So Moshe, we know he knew some Torah. And the same applies to our ancestors, to our patriarchs and matriarchs, that they also knew and kept the Torah. But it was not required. It was something they did, but it wasn't required. It was only known through prophecy. It was not given to them as a tablet, which happened later. And there was no revelation of God, which happened later. So there was no requirement for the Jews to keep the Torah. And so the only thing that they did that was, we'll say, required, I don't want to use, it's hard to say it's required, but they imposed upon themselves that they would maintain separate language and separate mode of dress. And that showed them to be a separate people.
They also lived in Goshen, would separate them physically as well.
Yeah, the place of living, that's true. Yosef set that up. The Medrash draws the contrast between Moshe, where the daughters say an Egyptian man saved us, to Yosef, that after he interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker, and then the butler comes before Paro, and then Paro has his dreams, and Paro can't get any good interpretation, and the butler says that now I remember my sins, we were in jail, and we dreamed. You remember the language?
It's something about an Ivri.
Right, Ivri. Right. There was a Nar Ivri. There was a lad who was Ivri from the other side of the river. It was a Hebrew. He didn't call him a Hebrew. Just from the other side of the river, a foreigner. And Yosef showed himself, projected himself as a foreigner. He did not project himself as an Egyptian. And as opposed to Moshe here, who projected himself as an Egyptian.
We can't really blame Moshe for it, because he didn't have a background, and he was not raised around Yaakov. He was raised in Pharaoh's house.
Okay, that's a good point.
So I don't think that's really a good comparison.
That you're making an excellent point, and again, it's going to be a subtlety. Moshe did have a good upbringing, because he was with his mother till he was weaned, and then the daughter of Paro raised them properly. Okay. So he did have a good upbringing, but you're right, it's not the same thing as growing up in Yaakov's house. Right. That's a whole different story.
Didn't he have to take off, you know, to flee? So he probably left with whatever he was wearing.
Right. That's true too. That's true too. You're saying he didn't really have time to change. Although it seems that this didn't happen right away afterwards. It seems that there was a lapse of time from when he ran away until this episode. The Medrash seems to say so, and it doesn't seem like it was one right after the other. But it's still a good point. That's still a good point.
And Midian is far from.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where it was. It was somewhere in the desert to the east of Egypt. South of Israel, somewhere in there, but I don't know where.
So where should Moshe have gotten clothes as an Ivri? I mean, he's coming from the palace, he's running away.
I'm sure there were places to get clothes.
There were stores along the way.
Yeah, yes. Stop at a local mall.
Local mall.
We wouldn't be discussing if it's a possibility.
So hard.
Now, why would there be this deal between Moshe and Yisro about the firstborn of Moshe. This is a very difficult thing. Mm-hmm. Now, many of the commentaries say that Moshe agreed to this knowing that eventually his father-in-law would come around and would himself, I mean, he had already repudiated idolatry. And so he knew that his father-in-law ultimately would see the beauty of Torah, which in fact does happen. As we know, later on after the Torah is given, Yisro comes and joins the Jewish people for a time in the wilderness. And therefore Moshe was willing to take the oath. He really had no choice. Yisro would not allow him to marry any of his daughters if he would not take this oath. Moshe felt that Yisro's daughters, Tzipora, was the correct woman for him, and he felt that taking the oath was a necessary step in order to marry her, and did not think that he would have to follow through with it in the end. The question really is why Yisro insisted on such a deal. And this is just an interesting thing to think about. We hear today, really today more than it's in the past, this was not the case. In the past, when a person had a child, you raised your child to follow your way of life. That's the way it was, always. You had your beliefs, your value system, even your occupation, and you raised your children in the same mode that you were in. And that's the way it always was. You had several generations living in the same house. Because everybody was in the same, this was the blacksmith family, and this was the tailor family, and this was the cobbler family. That was the way it was. With really very, very recently in history, we have a phenomenon where people don't want to impose their beliefs on their children, where people want their children to be able to experience it all. Let them experience and let them make their decisions. Now, nobody really does this, nobody with any sanity really does this to its extreme. If you take it to its extreme, then you essentially turn a child out onto the street without any direction whatsoever. Nobody with any sense would do such a thing. Everybody does give their children some direction. But nevertheless, there is this notion of why should I impose upon my child anything? Let my child have their own, let them taste everything for themselves and let them make an informed decision. It sounds very nice and it's actually very American, but the truth is it's born from a lack of conviction about our own values. A person who has conviction about their own values doesn't say that. If I believe that my values are 100% correct, if I believe that my values are the ones that were given by God on Har Sinai, I'm not going to want my child to taste everything else. I'm going to say, I want the best for my child. And if I have conviction that what I believe in is the best, then of course I'm going to train my child to do like me. Why would I want anything differently? Because we live at a time when most people, I'm not talking only about Jews, where most people don't really have strong conviction, where there's a lot of confusion and people really don't know what is truth, what is falsehood, what is real, what is fake, what is important, what is not important. And therefore, parents have a difficulty in imposing their belief system or their convictions on their children because they don't really have convictions. And that's where this whole notion comes from of let them experience for themselves. Let them try it out. Yisro went through a process where he tried out everything. He didn't have any parent who taught him a certain way. He started as a as a regular idolater, believing in paganism like everybody else, and he went through his own progress of trying this and trying that and trying the other one and keep saying, like, this doesn't make any sense, and that one doesn't make any sense, and that doesn't make sense, etc., 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 and eventually arriving at the conclusion that all these different forms of paganism are false, and it's only worthwhile to believe in one God. But nevertheless, Yisro arrived there through trial and error. That's how he got there. And Yisro believed, it seems, that was the better way to go. That in that way, your conviction of what you believe in is much stronger, because you've seen the other ones, you've tried the other ones, and you've rejected them. If you reject them, there's no question that your belief system is much stronger. In many ways, let's just give an example, something that we can relate to here. In many ways, someone who grew up in a religious home and never experienced, let's use pork as an example. So someone who, not necessarily a religious home, just in a family that never would eat pork. So if a person never tasted it, so okay, there's no interest in it. It's just something that you just don't do. Someone who has been involved with that and then rejected it, made an informed decision and said, this is wrong and I'm not going to do this anymore, and has made an informed decision, in many ways that's a stronger conviction than the person who never experienced it. The person who never experienced it might be tempted to try it out. And the person who has actively decided to give it up, that's in many ways much stronger. On the other hand, it works the other way as well. The person who has never tasted it may never even have an interest in it because they don't know what they're missing. All right, what's the big deal? But the person who once had it and liked it, even though they decided to move away from it, but it may be tugging at them because, that was really good. I wish I could have it again. That kind of thing. You can really go both ways over here. And for different people, it's going to go differently. And for different types of interests and different types of desires, it's going to go differently. I think most of us would say that if there's a highly addictive drug, then you're much better off not trying it out. Because if a person tries it out, they may get stuck and become addicted. Then again, a person who was addicted to that drug and fought tooth and nail and was able to get out of that addiction and is now totally free of the addiction, they're never going back. They won't go there. And they're going to run the other way if they're ever come in contact with it again. While someone who never had it might be tempted to give it a shot. Let me try it. So you can really argue both ways over here, and it's not a simple answer. So once the Torah is given and we have rules, so then we're required to keep the Torah, and we're required to teach our children to keep the Torah. So we can't use Yisro's idea of, well, let's just try everything out, because we're required to do what the Torah says. But before the Torah was given, which is where Yisro and Moshe were negotiating, there you can argue both sides of the coin. You can argue that maybe it's better to avoid it completely, never try it out, just worship the one God and don't go there. Remember, in their day, paganism was a strong desire. To us it seems silly, but to them, when there was a Yetzer Hara, where there was an inclination to do it, you recall we've talked about this several times, where there was a point in history where that evil inclination to worship idols was removed from the human race. But there was a time in history where it was a real desire, where no different than in the most intense desires people have today, that was paganism. And one could argue that don't go there, because if you go there, you'll become addicted. Don't try it. Or one could argue, no, try it, realize that it's false, realize that it's foolish, and then reject it. And that'll make you even stronger. This was the negotiation between Yisrael and Moshe. Yisrael argued, my way is better. Go from one to the other, try them out, reject them all, and arrive at the truth. Moshe says, that's not the way to do things. Don't go there. And what they agreed upon was the first child would try Yisro's method, and then after that, it would be Moshe's method. Moshe ends up having only two children, two sons. The oldest one, Gershom, goes in Yisro's direction, and Eliezer, the second one, in Moshe's direction. That is what happens between the two of them. Yeah.
That's a midrash.
Yes.
Okay. I know it's been explained to me many times. It doesn't stick, the midrash. What's a midrash?
It's the oral Torah.
It is. So God gave us that.
Well,
you have more than one for the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. So what you have to remember is that the transmission of the Torah has gone through times where there were issues of forgetting and arguing, etc. When the Torah was first given, both the written and oral Torah were given together, and they were understood fully. As time went on, and the transmission, it was transmitted from teacher to student, and it was understood fully until the exile, and then there was times where it got more difficult, which is why it got written down.
So you pick the one you like?
No. Either you say that they could be disagreeing with each other. You can have disagreements, just like in any area of Torah, you can have disagreement. But let's take a step back. The Medrash is on the same level, same time frame, and same level as the Mishnah. So Rabbi Akiva, who's the time of the Mishnah, it's on that level. Anybody following the Mishnah does not have the authority to argue with anybody from the Mishnaic times. Once you close the book of the Mishnah and you move into the Gemara or the Talmud, the sages of the Talmud, they don't argue with the sages of the Mishnah, because the sages of the Mishnah were greater. Because remember, we believe that as time goes on, we diminish in our abilities and our understanding. In this, we are in stark contrast to the culture around us, where the culture around us believes that science has improved and there has been a growing understanding of the world around us as time has gone on. And today's great thinkers are greater than the ones who came before them. We believe the opposite, that as we move on, our sages diminish and diminish and diminish. So where I am very comfortable having a Talmudic dispute with my peers in the Kollel, but I will not argue with my teachers from my yeshiva from Ner Yisrael in Baltimore, because I know that they know a lot more than I do, and they wouldn't argue with the generation before them, who wouldn't argue with the generation before them as you keep moving further and further back. So the Medrash, yes, there are disagreements and arguments in the Medrash, but they are between great sages themselves. It's not that the future generations can argue with the Medrash. So when you say choose what you like, we don't have the authority even to decide who's right and who's wrong.
There's another part here that said he had a promise that he would not leave Yisrael without asking permission.
Those were both true. He made two oaths. He took two oaths. One that he wouldn't leave without permission, and one about this firstborn son.
Oh, well, that covers
it. That now when they don't have to argue.
Okay.
Right.
Can I just go back to that? Okay, so the Medrash is part of the Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
It's
the same time frame, the same authority as the Mishnah.
Oh, okay. And then the Gemara came after the Mishnah?
The Gemara, any volume of Gemara mm-hmm. will start with Mishnah and then have the sages of the Gemara talk about the Mishnah. So it's the next stage later. The Mishnah was completed around the year 180, 190, somewhere in there. And the Gemara was completed around the year 500. So it's a little more than 300 years later.
Okay, and I thought the Talmud was the Mishnah and
the Gemara. That's right. The word Talmud includes them both.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
So then what is the difference between the Mishnah and the Midrash?
It's a question of what was compiled into what set. The Mishnah is really a halachic discussion. The Midrash often concerns itself with the episodes in the Chumash and in the Prophets.
Is there a book just with Midrash?
Yeah. And there are a few different Midrashim. It's not just there are several of them. Yeah.
I was thinking that maybe there's a possibility that Yisro was not, maybe his conviction wasn't so strong, and he was afraid he couldn't communicate that as well, and he wanted the child to have this firm learning experience.
It's possible. It's hard to know. The saying is that if you remove the requirement of the Torah from the equation, then the two sides of the argument, you can go both ways, and you can argue this all night long. What's the better way to go? And it'll come out that for different types of children, it's better to do it one way, and for different types of desires or
interests,
right? You'll want to do it differently. You know, how much instruction and how much experimentation you'll allow. You know, it'll be very different. Once the Torah is given, we don't have that choice, because the Torah says you got to do it this way, and that's, you know, we don't have the luxury of trying things out. But beforehand, one could argue both ways, and that's what happened here. You have Yisro and Moshe. Yisro has his experience to draw from. Moshe does not agree, and that's how we end up with two different approaches. In the end, the grandson of Moshe ends up involved in the difficult episode of Pesel Micha, of the idol that was that caused trouble in Israel after we got to Israel. There was an idol that there was a segment of the population that ended up involved in an idol called Micha. It was Micha's idol, and Moshe's grandson,
son of
Gershom, was one of the people involved with it. So it seems to have backfired. The Yisro's intention seems to have backfired in that way. That's something which we'll have to talk about when we have a chance, when we get to it in the book of Judges, which is after we finish the Chumash and Joshua and the Judges. So that's where that's discussed.
That'll be after Daniel.
A few years from now.
Okay, I do want to emphasize before we close, because I know I've spoken about it in the past, but I do want to emphasize that it's very important that we not judge the previous generations about their interest and desire in paganism and idolatry based on how we feel today. Because there was, as I mentioned, we don't have time tonight to go through the whole story, but there was an episode in history where it was actually removed from a person's desire. That it used to be the desire for idolatry and for paganism was real, and it was the strongest desire a person had.
What was the episode again that changed?
It had to do with the building of the Second Temple, and I don't like to say this because I don't like to talk about this sort of thing, but just understand just let's talk in terms of dollars. The $1 billion industry that is the industry of immorality today, of immoral relationships that goes on today. It's literally a $1 billion industry. The interest and desire in paganism exceeded that. And if that was still around today, that would be a $1 trillion industry. The industry of worshiping idols, of offering sacrifices, etc. So it's something which it's hard for us to even understand, because we look at it, it's foolish, it's silly. Like, look, who would do that? But that's because it's been removed from our system. We don't have that drive anymore in us. But they did. And it was a real battle, an inner struggle, not to go out and take an animal and slaughter it for the holy head of cabbage, or whatever they would worship.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.